We are in Job chapter 8. You can see from the outline that we are in the first round of talks. Job has given vent to his grief in chapter 3. He curses the day in which he was born, the night as well. Then Eliphaz has replied to Job, and Job's counter response in chapters 6 and 7. In chapter 8, the second of the three friends of Job now seeks to say something. And in chapters 9 and 10, Job answers him. You can see from this that however deep Job's sufferings are, he has his wits about him. He is not so distraught that he can't think very accurately, very acutely. And he's very quick-witted. So it's a very high level of intelligence here that's shown between Job and his friends. The only foolishness here is not what the friends say, but the way they apply it to Job. That's where they go wrong. Many of the things they say are really very informative and useful for us. Chapter 8, Bildad the Shuhite. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered, "How long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a mighty wind? Does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert what is right?" And what he is really saying here is exactly what Abraham said to God when he pleaded for those that might be righteous within the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham had said, "Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" And Bildad is saying the same thing. God does not pervert justice. He does not pervert what is right. But then there's a false assumption in verse 4 and a false insinuation in verse 6. He says, "If your sons sinned against him, then he delivered them into the power of their transgression." He is assuming there that Job's children died because they had sinned against God. That's not true. He says, "If you would seek God and implore the compassion of the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, surely now he would rouse himself for you and restore your righteous estate." There's a false insinuation there that maybe there's something with you too that isn't pure and upright. Maybe some of your wrong ways rubbed off onto your sons, and God has shown his displeasure by taking them away and by punishing you. So you can see that although the principle is right, it's the application is wrong. It is true that if we seek God and implore his compassion, he will rouse himself for us and restore us. Then he says, "Though your beginning was insignificant, yet your end will increase greatly." That is true also, because that's what happened to Job at the end of this book. He started out with nothing, or at least at the end of his trial he had nothing, but in the end he had twice as much as he had before. Then he goes on to say in verse 8, "Please inquire of past generations and consider the things searched out by their fathers. For we are only of yesterday and know nothing, because our days on earth are as a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and bring forth words from their minds?" There's another principle here that he lays down that is very important. It is very important to learn the lessons of history. We don't rely on present wisdom, but we garner the wisdom of the past. That's why you and I read good books. People say, "You've got the Bible." I remember when I was saved, someone said to me, my spiritual leader, "You've got the Bible. What do you need all those books for?" Because my wife and I were beginning to collect books and fill our bookshelf. Every time a good Christian, recommended a book, we went out and got it. And the thought was, "What do you need these books for? You've got the Bible." Yes, we do. But God has given those students of the Bible wisdom, insight, understanding, which we ourselves as individuals could never get. It's a kind of a corporate contribution. And so we are glad to learn from those to whom God gave wisdom and insight. And this is what Bildad is saying here. Please inquire of past generations. In the book of Proverbs, Solomon says, bow down thine ear and hear the sayings of the wise. The Bible must come first, but then the writings of men of God, great men of the past and even of the present, like Jim Packer, John Stott, and other great men, and Lloyd Jones, the late Dr. Lloyd Jones, and going back, if you have a taste for them, the Puritans, great men, great expositors. So we learn from them as well, because we are only of yesterday and know nothing, because our days on earth are as a shadow. Each one makes his contribution. You look at the giant reefs of Australia. How were they formed? Each little sea creature deposited a minute amount to added his minute contribution to those reefs. Millions of these, billions of them, finally formed those great reefs of Australia. And so it is that you and I each have a part to play, each have a contribution to make. And it would be foolish to ignore the contributions of the past. Then he goes on to say, verse 11, can the papyrus grow up without marsh? Can the rushes grow without water? While it is still green and not cut down, yet it withers before any other plant. So are the paths of all who forget God, and the hope of the godless will perish, whose confidence is fragile and whose trust a spider's web. Now he's comparing the paths of those who forget God, he's comparing the godless to those plants that grow up in the marsh or in the mud. And what he's saying is, sin and evil flourish in the suitable circumstances. Can the rush grow up without mire? That's how the King James puts it. So wherever there's mire, there's sure to be found the papyrus or the rush. Can the rushes grow without water? Evil circumstances give opportunity for evil people. But he says, just like those green plants sprout up and then they're cut down while they're still green, so do the godless who for a while flourish and then they are removed. He says their confidence is fragile and their trust is spider's web. A spider's web is very intricate, but it is also very fragile. And he's saying here, the wicked people may sprout and grow under promising circumstances, but soon enough they're removed from the scene. And now, although it is true, he is really hinting that Job is one of those. He says, you were green and flourishing because your circumstances were right, but now you have been cut down. You see the hint that he's throwing out all the time. Verse 15, he trusts in his house, but it does not stand. Maybe that's a hint to the fact that the house of his children fell down, was blown down. He holds fast to it, but it does not endure. He thrives before the sun, and his shoots spread out over his garden. But verse 18, if he is removed from his place, then it will deny him, saying, I never saw you. Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the dust others will spring. Well, that's what happens to those who are hypocrites, those who are godless. Their prosperity is short-lived. Their joy vanishes. There's nothing left for them. They have no successors, no memorial. But then he goes on to say, verse 20, lo, God will not reject a man of integrity, nor will he support the evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more. If you are that man, you're all right, Job. God will arise for your deliverance and for your vindication. Job, in chapter 9 and 10, answers Bildad. Then Job answered, "In truth I know that this is so, but how can a man be in the right before God?" Bildad had been speaking about a man of integrity. But Job says, it's all very well to speak of integrity, but how can a man be in the right before God? It's much more than outward works needed here. Holiness is needed. We need to be justified before God, but we cannot. How can we be? He goes on to describe how we are really unrighteous creatures. He says in verse 3, if one wished to dispute with him, he could not answer him once in a thousand times. There's no way in which we can vindicate ourselves before God. There's no way we can clear ourselves and say, I am pure. This is what he's saying. Wise in heart and mighty in strength, who has defied him without harm? He speaks about God's wisdom and God's omnipotence. In verse 4, wise in heart and mighty in strength. Then verse 5, it is God who removes the mountains, they know not how, when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble. It may be that he's thinking of the time when there was some vast change in the earth's crust. There's a theory that continental plates are floating and moving, and that's why we get earthquakes and upheavals. But it also could be that in the past the landmass was one whole piece, that it got split up. There's a verse in Genesis which speaks about a certain man. His name was Peleg. His father called him Peleg because in his days the earth was divided. People have wondered about that statement. In his days the earth was divided. And some have come to the conclusion it must be that in his days the land masses broke apart from each other and separated from one another. It's possible. But anyway, he speaks about God that he shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble. In verse 7, he says, who commands the sun not to shine and sets a seal upon the stars. Again, you can see the scientific insight of these men. Where is it that God commands the sun not to shine and sets a seal upon the stars? Well, one place we can think about is the Arctic. It's called the land of the midnight sun. But for 6 months or so, the sun isn't there. It's dark. It's night for half the year. And it might be that he knew about this. Verse 8, who alone stretches out the heavens and tramples down the waves of the sea. Job also shows here that he knows about the constellations and their connection with the weather. Who makes the Bear, Orion, and the Pleiades. I think the Pleiades are part of the Milky Way. And the chambers of the south, who does great things unfathomable and wondrous works without number. He speaks about God's great creation of the universe. Verse 11, were he to pass by me, I would not see him. Were he to move past me, I would not perceive him. Verse 13, God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him crouch the helpers of Rahab. Rahab here is a word that is not only a term for Egypt. Egypt is termed Rahab, but it's also used of the proud people. And what he's saying here is, beneath him crouch all those who help the proud. And so he says, with God's wisdom, his omnipotence, going back to verse 4, wise in heart and mighty in strength, he says, you can see there's no way I can stand before God. Verse 14, how then can I answer him and choose my words before him? For though I were right, I could not answer. I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. He is confessing freely here that even though we may have right on our side, yet there is so much lacking, there's so much wrong, that we would not be able to stand before God and say, I'm right. We cannot justify ourselves before God. He says, I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. If I'm caught speeding, it's no use me saying to the judge at the court, suppose I challenge the speeding ticket and I go to court, it's no use me saying to the judge in the court, but I've never committed murder. You say, you're not up here on the charge of murder. You're up here for breaking the speed limit. So it's no use us saying, I haven't done this and I haven't done that. What about the things we have done? And so Job says, I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I could not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he bruises me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. Verse 19, if it is a matter of power, behold, he is the strong one. And if it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? I'm beaten. I've lost, hands down. I have nothing to plead in my defense before a holy and a righteous God. What he's really saying is what the Word of God says. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. There is none righteous, no, not one. That's why he goes on to say, verse 20, though I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. Though I am guiltless, he will declare me guilty. Though in my eyes I am righteous, for me to say I am righteous will condemn me. There's that old joke about someone gave me a badge for humility, but when I wore it, they took it away. The same kind of thing here. This is what he's saying. Though I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. If I say I'm righteous, immediately that proves that I'm not. Then he says, verse 21, I am guiltless. I do not take notice of myself. I despise my life. He's not saying he is entirely righteous, but he's talking about his sufferings. I haven't done anything to deserve these sufferings. But is he right in what he says in verse 22? It is all one, therefore I say, he destroys the guiltless and the wicked. If the scourge kills suddenly, he mocks the despair of the innocent. Now that's not necessarily true. This is Job speaking in his despair. This is one of the things that later on another young man picks him up on. Another young man who comes into the picture called Elihu. He'll appear in chapter 32. There were some things that Job said that were not fair, that were not true. Verse 25. Now my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away, they see no good. He describes the brevity of his life. And he says, my days are swifter than a runner. Or in verse 26, they slip by like reed boats. There's another cultural window. In those days, they did have boats made of reeds lashed together. You've heard of Thor Heyerdahl, who built a boat like that to try and trace the travels across the ocean of the ancient people, the ancient explorers. Reed boats were specially swift, and bundles of reeds lashed together made very buoyant ships, and they resisted decay and damage. He also mentions that his days slip by like an eagle that swoops on its prey. There are eagles called harpic eagles. It comes from the Greek word to snatch away. They move so fast that you can't see them with the naked eye when they're swooping. Even the camera records their motion as a blur. And he's saying here, this is how my days are going by, like an eagle that swoops on its prey. There's an eagle. It's like a dot in the sky that sees a gopher. Down it comes. And it comes down so fast that the gopher hasn't got it, barely make it to its little hole, to its little refuge. And oftentimes it doesn't make it, because before you know it, the eagle's there on top of it, grabbing it. He was using this picture to show how quick his days were passing by. And then he says, verse 27, there's no way either that I can ignore my predicament. Verse 27, though I say I will forget my complaint, I will leave off my sad countenance and be cheerful, I am afraid of all my pains. I know that thou wilt not acquit me. So I can pretend that it's not happening, I can harden myself, but I know that even for this I will be called to account. It's the whole doctrine of God's dealing with us, that what he does to us is meant to bring a response from us. And so he says, if I ignore what God is doing to me, God will ask me, why didn't you listen to me? Didn't you realize that what I did to you was meant to attract your attention? Then he says in verse 29, I am accounted wicked, why then should I toil in vain? He is now contradicting what his friends Eliphaz and Bildad have said. If I am a wicked man, why then should I toil in vain? What he's really saying is, it's the wicked who seem to be getting away with things. Here I am, I'm a righteous man, and I'm in deep trouble. Why is it like this? Look at this also in Psalm 73. Let's look at that problem that another man faced, called Asaph. In Psalm 73, we find that Asaph, another man of God, also faced the same problem. Why is it that the bad people are happy and the good people are sad? Psalm 73. Surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet came close to stumbling. My steps had almost slipped, for I was envious of the arrogant as I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no pains in their death, and their body is fat. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like mankind. Therefore pride is their necklace, the garment of violence covers them, their eye bulges from fatness, the imaginations of their heart run riot. Then he goes on to say in verse 12, behold, these are the wicked, and always at ease, they have increased in wealth. Surely in vain I have kept my heart pure and washed my hands in innocence, for I have been stricken all day long and chastened every morning. He was tempted to talk like this, but then he pulls himself up in verse 15. If I had said, I will speak thus, behold, I should have betrayed the generation of thy children. But then he goes on in the psalm to say, when I came into the sanctuary of God, then I saw it from God's perspective, and I saw that it was the other way to what I had supposed. They were having it all in this life, but there was nothing to come after this life. But for me, God was laying up an inheritance in heaven. Well, Job here is tempted to say what Asaph held himself back from saying. Job here comes out with it. I am accounted wicked, why then should I toil in vain? He says, If I try and cleanse myself, yet I know that before God all my blemishes will appear. In the half light, you and I can get away with grubby hands. Nobody would notice our grubby hands in the half light, in the twilight or in the dusk. But come into a brightly lit room and every bit of dirt, speck of dirt can be seen. And this is what he's saying here, verse 30. If I should wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, yet thou wouldst plunge me into the pit and my own clothes would abhor me. No way can I appear before God in my righteousness. Isaiah says all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. Then he goes on to say in verse 32, for he is not a man as I am, that I may answer him, that we may go to court together. He's really longing for the opportunity to meet with God in court and to clear his case. He'll be saying this more and more as he goes along. But right now he says, I wish God was in human form so that I could talk to him mouth to mouth, face to face, without any fear, without any terror, on the same level as himself, and that we could go to court together. Then I could plead my case, defend myself, and also demand justice for myself. He says in verse 33, there is no umpire between us who may lay his hand upon us both. I need an umpire. Someone that is capable of contacting God, who is the unseen Holy One, and me, who are the seen and the sinful one. I need someone who is capable of reaching God at his level and me on my level. But I don't have such an umpire. There is no umpire between us. He pleads and he says, verse 34, let him remove his rod from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak and not fear him. But I am not like that in myself. I must say that sometimes the King James scores over the modern translators, because once in a while in these translations, the translation is quite puzzling. Anyway, on the whole, it's all right. In chapter 10, Job goes on, I loathe my own life. I will give full vent to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why thou dost contend with me. Is it right for thee indeed to oppress, to reject the labor of thy hands, and to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked? Why is it that you have allowed these Chaldeans and these Sabaeans in their schemes to take away all that I had? Why is it that you have allowed all this disaster to come upon me? He speaks to God and he pleads with him and he says, you are not a human being who has limited vision. Verse 4, hast thou eyes of flesh, or dost thou see as a man sees? The Lord himself said to the men of his generation, do not judge according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. And one of the descriptions of the Messiah that you'll find in Isaiah chapter 11 is that he does not judge after the sight of his eyes. Isaiah 11 verse 3, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. There's a description of the coming Savior, and we see that one of the vital characteristics of a righteous Savior is that he doesn't judge by what he sees or by what he hears. He's able to penetrate beyond the external appearance. He's able to evaluate beyond what he has been told. And all of us need to learn this lesson. Well, he says to God, you're treating me just like fallible mortal. Verse 5, are thy days as the days of a mortal, or thy years as man's years, that thou should seek for my guilt and search after my sin? According to thy knowledge, I am indeed not guilty, and yet there is no deliverance from thy hand. He's saying here to God that as far as I know, I am not guilty, and you know very well that I am not guilty. That's a very bold claim. I have not done anything to deserve this. He keeps saying this to God. Verse 8, thy hands fashioned and made me altogether, and wouldst thou destroy me? Remember now that thou hast made me as clay, and wouldst thou turn me into dust again? Then in verse 10, he describes how he was formed from an embryo into a human body. Didst thou not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh, and knit me together with bones and sinews? That's the process of the formation of a baby. First of all, there are the fluids, and then they finally form a little embryo, and from then that embryo begins to take shape. And even very early, when you look at the ultrasound pictures of those tiny embryos, maybe only an inch and a half, you can see the little heart beating very, very fast. And you know it is a living creature. He says, you've curdled me like cheese. Well, that's how cheese is formed. First of all, there's the milk, and then finally it's solidified through a process into cheese. And then you clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews. He says, you've taken such great care to form me, to give me being and wholeness, and then what do? You treat me like a clay vessel. Here's the potter. He's been speaking about it. Thy hands fashioned and made me altogether. Here's the potter. He's made his beautiful clay jar, and then what does he do? He smashes it. How contrary of the potter to spend all that time and trouble making a clay jar just to break it. And he says, why are you doing this? It doesn't make sense. Thou hast granted me life and loving kindness, and thy care has preserved my spirit. Yet these things thou hast concealed in thy heart. I know that this is within thee. I don't know what to do, he says. Either way, I can't win. Verse 14 and 15. If I sin, then thou wouldst take note of me and wouldst not acquit me of my guilt. If I am wicked, woe to me. All right, that's on one side. But on the other side, and if I am righteous, I dare not lift up my head. I am sated with disgrace and conscious of my misery. So either way, I lose. Heads you win, tails I lose. That kind of thing. Verse 17, he says, thou dost renew thy witnesses against me and increase thine anger toward me. Hardship after hardship is with me. Then, he says, why then hast thou brought me out of the womb? Why did you allow me to be born? Why did you spend so much trouble on me? Why did you bestow such great blessings? Why did you give me so many riches? Why did you honor me with so many beautiful children only to take them away? What's the sense of it? That's his plea here. Would that I had died and no eye had seen me. I should have been as though I had not been, carried from womb to tomb. So you can see he is in deep gloom at this point. Then Zophar replies. Zophar of the three seems to be the hardest. Then Zophar the Naamathite answered, shall a multitude of words go unanswered, and a talkative man be acquitted? Shall your boasts silence men, and shall you scoff and none rebuke? For you have said, my teaching is pure, and I am innocent in your eyes. but would that God might speak and open his lips against you. He's saying here, you're talking foolishness here, but if God were to speak, you would see how, you'd see by the light of what he said, how foolish you are to speak like this. Know then that God forgets a part of your iniquity. That's at the end of verse 6. When he says sound wisdom has two sides, know then that God forgets a part of your iniquity. He's saying there's much more to sound wisdom than you think. In Jeremiah chapter 17 and verse 18, Jeremiah says, let those who persecute me be put to shame, but as for me, let me not be put to shame. Let them be dismayed, but let me not be dismayed. Bring on them a day of disaster and crush them with twofold destruction. I have difficulty with the translation, because what Zophar is saying here is that when he says God forget a part of your iniquity, he's saying God exacts less of you than your iniquity deserves. And what he's saying here, Jeremiah is saying here, is treat me in this way. Do not bring upon me the complete judgment for what I have done wrong. In Isaiah, we read that Jerusalem has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. And Zophar is saying here to Job that God, although he is exacting from you, he may be exacting from you double for your sins, still it is less than what you deserve. It's rather a hard speech. It's difficult to say to someone who has lost everything, well, we could be worse. It could be worse. Verse 7, can you discover the depths of God? Can you discover the limits of the Almighty? He says, God is past finding out. God is inscrutable. Verse 11 and 12, for he knows false men and he sees iniquity without investigating. And an idiot will become intelligent when the foal of a wild donkey is born a man. Literally, a vain man would be wise, although he's born like a wild donkey's colt. I suppose this is another way of putting it, that an idiot will become intelligent when the foal of a wild donkey is born a man. But it's a clumsy translation. Anyway, Zophar goes on in verse 13. If you would direct your heart right and spread out your hand to him, if iniquity is in your hand, put it far away. Now that's good advice. If you would direct your heart right and spread out your hand to him, if iniquity is in your hand, put it far away and do not let wickedness dwell in your tents. When we want to pray to God, one thing we must be sure of, that we are right with God. David says, if I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. So if we try and pray to God while we're harboring secret sin, God's not going to listen to us. You have the same principle in marriage. Here, husband and wife, they're at loggerheads with one another, and each is convinced that the other is wrong. So neither will apologize to the other. When they come to pray, they find they can't pray. Their prayers are being hindered. Peter says, you are to be heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. There's only one thing to be done. They've both got to swallow their pride and they've got to make it up. And until they do, they're not going to get anywhere in their prayers. This kind of advice, this kind of counsel comes at the time when it's most difficult to accept it. But that's the way the marriage survives. you've just got to give in. You've just got to learn to say, I'm sorry I was wrong, or I'm sorry, for please forgive me. And this is what he's saying here now. We find it repeated again, the same principle, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11 to the believers in Corinth, there's something wrong with you. You're coming together, you're ostensibly, it's to observe the Lord's Supper. But things are going terribly wrong for you. Verse 27. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 27. Therefore, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner shall be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks judgment to himself, if he does not judge the body rightly. For this reason, many among you are weak and sick, and a number sleep. Because they didn't approach God in the right manner, many of them had died prematurely. They hadn't lost their souls, but certainly their earthly life was prematurely ended. But if we judged ourselves rightly, we should not be judged. But when we are judged, we are disciplined by the Lord in order that we may not be condemned along with the world. Certainly you don't lose your souls. But there are such things as disobedient believers who stubbornly refuse to obey God, and God takes them away. They do get to heaven, but their useful life on earth is prematurely curtailed. And what Zophar is saying to Job is absolutely right. If iniquity is in your hand, put it far away, and do not let wickedness dwell in your tents. Then indeed you could lift up your face without moral defect, and you would be steadfast and not fear. For you would forget your trouble. As waters that have passed by, you would remember it. Excellent counsel, but given to the wrong person. Job didn't need this. He was doing the best he knew. He was a man that God himself described as perfect and upright, one that feared God and that was departing from evil. Any time he found something wrong, he put it right in his life. But still, the advice itself is good, and one that we can apply to ourselves in the time of need. It might be that we are in trouble through our own failings. But when we turn to God and we confess it and put it away, He is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. And our troubles will be like waters that have passed by. We'll remember our troubles as things of the past. And your life would be brighter than noonday. Darkness would be like the morning. Then you would trust, because there is hope, and you would look around and rest securely. The wonderful thing about chastisements and chastenings, unpleasant experiences, when God has to deal with us and discipline us, the wonderful thing about them is that once we have gone through them and we've learned our lesson, we find that they've kept us, they've immunized us from far worse things. As one old writer put it, God will allow us sometimes to stumble to save us from a big fall, because it has, as it were, forewarned me against the greater dangers that I am now facing. It works. It is a matter of sheer experience among the people of God. And so David says, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I have kept thy commandments. We can thank God. And again, as an old writer said, once the messenger is heard, he leaves. Once we hear the message behind God's discipline and we respond, God lifts the discipline. You've learned your lesson, the discipline is ended. But if you kick and you scream and you struggle and you keep defying God,
it lasts a lot longer. So the sooner we learn our lesson, the better for us. Well, so he says in verse 19, you would lie down and none would disturb you, and many would entreat your favor. But the eyes of the wicked will fail, and there will be no escape for them, and their hope is to breathe their last. Zophar, speaking to Job, what he had to say was excellent. The only problem was, it wasn't Job he needed to be telling. It wasn't Job he needed to tell about these things. Well, we'll take a break for a quarter of an hour, and then we'll come back and look at what Job said in reply.